countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Now on RTE Radio 1, countrywide with Damien O'Reilly.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, fattening the goose for Christmas, the government roadmap for reducing agri emissions, Marty Morrissey on an historic sporting weekend for camogie and hurling, and King of the Swingers, Paddy Cole, live in studio.
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie, and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, COVID-19 has forced many of us to have a rethink about our relationship with food. Working from home or being forced to be out of work has resulted in more home cooking and baking. And this, in turn, has seen a surge in the sale of traditional products such as meat, eggs, fruit and vegetables. And this also includes, interestingly enough, mushrooms. Statistics earlier this year showed that in April, May and June, when we were at the height of the first lockdown, sales of mushrooms surged by over 20% in Ireland. Now, 100% of mushrooms sold in this country are grown here in Ireland. And this surge in sales is good news for at least one Meath-based family business. Next year, 2021, Kerrigan's Mushrooms near Kells in County Meath will celebrate 40 years in business. John Kerrigan's grandfather arrived from Galway in 1940 after getting a 25-acre farm from the Land Commission.
They started in the beginning with a little bit of tillage and cows and that, and they started sending milk to the Dublin dairies.
But John decided he wanted to grow mushrooms and set up on this small 3-acre site in 1981. 4 decades on, and there are over 100 people employed supplying mushrooms to supermarkets across the country.
So why did you decide to go growing mushrooms?
Well, we were looking, what could you do on a small bit of land? And I suppose that's what brought us to something like this, an intensive enterprise. So we started just growing a few three mushroom tunnels in the beginning, and we started growing from there.
While the Kerrigans don't export any produce, 80% of mushrooms grown commercially in Ireland at a value of €120 million are exported to the UK. And while the full impact of Brexit on the sector remains largely unknown, John Kerrigan is not immune from that uncertainty.
For these last months and a few years, we've been just sweating it out to see what's going to happen, because if there isn't a good trade deal, it will affect the whole industry. 80% of the mushrooms grown in the country are exported. So they are our fellow growers, and that we all work together, we all need compost. So we all need that critical mass of mushrooms grown in the country to make it viable.
There are 18 tunnels growing mushrooms here in this rural part of County Meath. John's daughter, Karen, takes me inside to have a look.
Okay, so Damien, when my dad started off, there was 2 tunnels here. Now we've grown to 8 tunnels, but when he started off, it was all grown in bags on the ground. Now we've introduced a shelving system, so you get economies of scale, we can grow more mushrooms here. So we started off with about 2 employees, and we've over 100 employees here employed.
So you have 100 staff here working now. I presume they're not all Irish.
We've a great international mix of staff here, you know. Our farm manager, Martha, she started off here picking mushrooms. She worked her way through. She had only Polish when she came. She taught herself English, Russian. Now she's running the whole farm. You know, and that's just wonderful. And she's such an asset to the company.
Karen, what's the output here?
So we grow about 60,000 kilos of mushrooms a week on the farm here. And we're supplying out to the Irish retailers. So every day we're up early. We're picking around 5 o'clock in the morning. And then that day we're getting the mushrooms out to our customers, so the customer know that they have the freshest mushrooms on those shelves every day.
And this year has seen an increase in the demand and consumption of mushrooms in this country. The jump has been something like 20%. Why is that?
I think, like everyone, COVID has made us all rethink how we do things. We're all at home more, we're cooking more. I know myself with two kids, I don't think I've ever cooked as much. I'm at home, and especially with mushrooms, they love to help me out. And, you know, mushrooms are great, they're so versatile and quick to use. So, like, you can have them for your breakfast, and then you can put them into bolognese and meatballs and stuff like that, because I know it's hard to get the veggies in, but mushrooms are a great one to get in.
And how has this year been running a business, you know, where you have a lot of employees working indoors, dealing with COVID?
You know, hygiene has always been paramount on the farms, but we did have to relook at things. We did look at our teams. We did reduce them into smaller sizes, our picking and packing teams. We staggered our tea breaks, our starting times, our finishing times. We introduced more canteen facilities so people could be spread out more. We also introduced a facial clock-in system, so a thermal clock-in system, so everyone's temperature is read when they come in the morning and when they leave. So, you know, we wanted to give confidence to the employees that when they came to work, they were safe, and that we were carrying out, like, an essential job. We were putting food on customer shelves.
Mushrooms grow fast, but must be sold fast too. As a perishable product with only a few days shelf life, efficiency is key. But sustainability and minimum waste are also important to John Kerrigan.
It's very, very important. So we put in a wood chip boiler. So that has cut down our carbon footprint a lot. So it's from that point of view, we have to be looking at sustainability. It's the way forward. We don't use any chemicals whatsoever on the farm, so we sterilise all our growing rooms with steam. So to generate that steam took a lot of oil. Now at the moment we do it with wood chip, and that's much easier. And we're looking at putting in solar panels for power and all that to them. We look at from farm to fork, so we want to do it right. Mushrooms, we grow them all the year round. The only day we don't pick mushrooms is Christmas Day. We pick every other day of the year, and we deliver to the shops every other day of the year.
And John, when it comes to waste compost or compost waste, how do you dispose of that?
Well, it's a great byproduct. What we grow our mushrooms on, when it's finished at the end of 6 weeks, it's very, very good compost. We have a big demand, especially from tillage farmers. They are constantly looking for something to put on their land that has been, you know, got artificial manures over the year. And anyone that has used it has got great, great results from it. So we don't have a problem getting rid of the compost. It's great. It's Irish compost. It's made in Wexford. It's custom made for us. It has the spawn in. It's peak heated. It's ready to go when we get it. A good product.
And a recyclable one, as you say.
And a recyclable one. No waste. That's our motto. No waste.
And eat your mushrooms. John Kerrigan there. Before that, his daughter. They're one of the few mushroom businesses in Ireland not exporting heavily to the UK. But like all farmers, they'll be keeping an eye on the Brexit story. This is a crucial 36 hours in negotiations. And across RTE Radio 1 and RTE News, we'll be bringing you the latest developments. But for now, I suppose all we can do is hold our breath. Well, aside from Brexit, one of the other massive challenges facing us all, and farmers in particular, is meeting climate change targets. And this week, the Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue, launched a national climate and air roadmap for the agricultural sector. It's entitled Ag Climatise. The roadmap sets out an ambitious vision for a climate neutral agriculture sector by the year 2050. It's received mixed reaction, and with me now is Fran McNulty, who's RTE's Agriculture and Consumer Affairs correspondent. Fran, good morning.
Morning, Damien.
So what is this Ag Climatise strategy all about?
It's about making a plan, putting something on paper, Damien, that looks at reducing emissions in the agri sector. It is the source of 35% of all greenhouse gas emissions in Ireland. Many of our listeners will probably be familiar with the Chagas-Mack curve. It sounds technical, but it's an abatement cost curve, and it looked at a range of issues. Anyone who's read that or read about it over the years will be familiar with a lot of the terminology and some of the measures that are addressed in this new plan from Charlie McConnellogue. Ag Climatise talks about a 20% reduction in nitrogen use, 10% cut in ammonia emissions. It aims to double the amount of lime which we're spreading on our land, and low-emission slurry-spreading technology is really going to be dramatically ramped up. It's setting a target of 90% of slurry being applied by low-emission means by 2027. Now, Damien, it's 22 pages long. It also deals with feed, breeding, biomethane, enhanced organics, biodiversity, and a range of other measures that will help in this fight against reducing greenhouse gases. But what I suppose farmers and rural dwellers are looking at are the changes in practice, the changes in housing needed, the change in equipment, the fact that there could be more scrutiny, more red tape, and many of them are really beginning to ask now, how is all of this going to tie into the new cap and into the various payment schemes as well?
Yeah, it sounds like a nationalist, I suppose, version of the EU Green Deal Farm to Fork proposal, which was published earlier this year. Now, there are, of course, two main groups that will react that are very close to this. Stakeholders that would have been consulted, I'm sure, in the lead up to this announcement last week, along with the public consultation. And they are obviously farmers and environmental organisations. Let's start with the environmentalists. What have they said in reaction to this, Fran?
Well, four words, Damien, they are not happy. Many of them are saying it just doesn't go far enough at all. The environmental pillar, which is one of the bigger groups and the more representative groups, it went as far as to say that this plan, and I'll quote what they say, it perpetuates business as usual practices that will continue to wreak havoc on our environment. That's what they said in their opening statement about this. They're saying that it does welcome certain aspects of the roadmap, like the promotion of organic farming. There are commitments in there to improve national food security and to increase farm-led carbon capture. But it said the plan is completely insufficient. Environmental groups, they do have a concern that if the issues around agriculture and the emissions from agriculture aren't dealt with radically, and they always use the word radically, Damien, they say then if that doesn't happen, the emissions reduction targets for 2030, which are recommitted to in this plan, they may not be met. And they're saying then that overall reach, which is a big one, of carbon neutral, having a carbon neutral economy by 2050, they say that also could be at risk if something radical doesn't happen. And they've said that the plan calls for the stabilisation of methane emissions, and they're saying it should actually call for outright reductions in methane emissions. And any plan that doesn't do that, Damien, simply won't cut it with the environmental lobby. And that phrase, stabilisation of methane emissions, has proved as a bit of a sticking point from their perspective over the past couple of days.
OK, and what about the farmers, in particular the representative organisations? What have they been saying?
Mixed. Not surprisingly, they do have a very different take on things to the environmental lobby. The agriculture lobby is saying that the IFA in particular, it immediately began to point out all that was been done in the sector. They pointed to the fact that agri emissions were actually down last year. Tim Cullinan had a right cut at people who were talking about reducing the national herd. He went on the news at one on the day Charlie McConnell published this document, and he said there was no such thing as a national herd. He said rather there were individual farmers who were trying to make money, and he said they needed to be helped to improve efficiency of animals, and that would help in turn to reduce emissions. Look at productivity and look at increasing efficiency. Of course, Damien, he's wrong. There is a national herd. There are more than 7.5 million cattle in the country, and they do make the sector the single biggest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. Animals are the bulk of that figure. And Tim Cullinan putting out a statement saying that people shouldn't get sidetracked by the herd reduction debate. Damien, we know that this becomes a separate argument, though, when you start to talk about how we don't really have an industrialised base here, that there's a really, we have a heavy dependence in agriculture, and that does skew the figure somewhat. And I suppose the ICMSA really took a different tack to the IFA. Pat McCormack came out and said that the president of the ICMSA said that plan was premised on a basic delusion that all of the change that our farming and food production system needs could happen from the supermarket loading bay back to the farm. Pat McCormack said that is a fundamental mistake. He said, and because that had happened, it ensured that the plan wouldn't get the kind of buy-in it needs to make it work. But most farmers you talk to on the ground know that change is coming. They see it. They read about it every day. They listen to it on the radio on a regular basis. They know that pressure is on to deal with emissions. And many of them are already taking steps to deal with that. I mean, you've seen it. I've seen it out on farms. They want to see real measurement of their contribution to carbon capture. They feel that what they do already in their hedgerows, in their planting, and all the various things they have on their land isn't measured. And they say that if all of that was being measured in addition to all of the various measures like increasing efficiency and reducing emissions from cattle and other animals, that would help create balance. And they see that balance really isn't there.
Okay, and just finally, Fran, you touched on a phrase there which has entered the lexicon in recent times, industrial agriculture. It'd be good to get a quantify exactly what that means in an Irish context. But we do know that the dairy herd has increased by some 400 head over the last 5 years since the abolition of milk quotas. And we do know, as you say, that 80% of pollution from agriculture, or indeed emissions, or the carbon from agriculture, is in the form of methane emissions. And this is the bogey in the room, I suppose, the increase in the dairy herd. Are we looking at any stage, do you think, Fran, in the terms of stabilising the methane emissions, at probably another quasi form of capping the amount of animals that dairy farmers can have? In other words, reintroducing a local form of quotas?
It's something which the farming organisations don't want to touch at all, Damien. In fact, we interviewed the minister about this up in Donegal when the plan was being launched earlier in the week, and we explicitly asked him about herd reduction, about the possibility of it, about kind of how he would see herd numbers in 2030 if all of this was to be met. And he simply said that the plan is premised on stabilising livestock numbers. Like, there has been criticism of the fact that it hasn't called for targeted reductions or reductions in any respect. What the plan does do, it actually says that all of this can only happen if those numbers are stabilised. And it says that a continually increasing livestock numbers, it simply can't work. And that is kind of where the issue is. Many people feel privately, if you talk to them, mm-hmm. that something along that those lines is probably coming. And that's where a lot of the criticism for this plan has come from. I think, Damien, what it's about, really, this plan is about easing people in. Now, environmentalists would say the time for easing people in is way gone. But if you look at the debate around this, Damien, it can sometimes be very toxic. You're either for or against. Farmers are demonised, environmentalists are disregarded. But it's not black and white. Richard Starrett, who's a very highly regarded dairy farmer up in Donegal, said to us during the week, farmers don't want to destroy the environment. They want to be custodians of the land. Okay. They want to protect it and hand it back. And what this document is about is beginning that debate, beginning a discussion, and trying to get both sides to face up to the reality that there needs to be change, and to target exactly what that change needs to be.
All right. Fran McNulty, RTE's Agriculture and Consumer Affairs correspondent, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on that document launched this week.
RTE Radio 1. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Yeah, well, something that will sum up the year 2020 is that less than 2 weeks out from Christmas, the All-Ireland Camogie and Hurling Finals are taking place this weekend in front of a virtually empty Croke Park. Nevertheless, the excitement and anticipation remains at fever pitch in all four counties involved. So my friend and colleague, who occasionally has the pleasure of stepping into this chair when needed, also happens to be RTE's GA correspondent, the great Marty Morrissey, and he joins us. Marty, good morning. There's a bit of a delay, so I'll continue on with my first question. Tonight, 7 o'clock, the All-Ireland Camogie final takes place. It's a repeat of last year's final between Galway and Kilkenny. Kilkenny have lost a good few in recent years. It's going to be a really great occasion, and the fact that it's under lights this evening as well.
Good morning, Damien. Yes, indeed, it is historic in so many ways. Galway are going for back-to-back All-Ireland titles. Sarah Dervin could only become the first captain since in successive years to lift the cup, since Dublin's Kathleen Ryder did it back in 1966. It's under lights. Kilkenny have been in every All-Ireland final since 2013, bar 2015, and including the last five, but they've only won in 2016. So there's an awful lot at stake. And these two counties met, of course, last year, and it was a bit of a humdinger. I think there was 6 points between them at the end. Mm-hmm. But you have probably some of the greatest players in the game of camogie on view tonight, and it'll be live on television. I mean, it's when you look at the Kilkenny lineup: Anne Dalton, Denise Gall, Aoife Doyle, Miriam Walsh, Megan Farrell, Anna Farrell. These are just brilliant players, and they're going to really put up a major challenge to Galway, who likewise have outstanding players. My God, when you think of Niamh Kilkenny, Camogie Player of the Year last year, with Aoife Donoghue back at midfield. They were the all-star midfield last year, and they're combining again tomorrow. Niamh Hanafy, Ailish O'Reilly, Carrie Dolan has been the outstanding scorer for Galway, and Sarah Healy, who's only, 20, 21. She's the all-star goalkeeper from St. Thomas's. So we're really looking forward to it. And it is a very special day for women's sport tomorrow. It's Super Saturday with the FAI Cup final happening as well. And it's all happening on RTE. And I hope that people will tune in all day later on this afternoon and evening.
Yeah, no, there's been a great build-up to it. And a build-up continuing then as well tomorrow for this novel pairing in an All-Ireland hurling final, two Munster teams. You've been in both counties this week, despite the fact it's getting near Christmas. Is the excitement the same as it would have been in the first Sunday of September or back in August last year?
Well, to be honest with you, it's very different. There is huge excitement. I mean, the colours and the buntings and the flags are out, but nobody will be selling the flags and the buntings tomorrow outside Croke Park. But within Limerick and Waterford, there is a huge sense of anticipation. I mean, Waterford haven't won the All-Ireland since 1959. That was a time when Eamon de Valera was Taoiseach for the first half of the year. Then Sean Lamass came in, Eamon de Valera becoming the President of Ireland subsequently. And you'd think of the great men that were on that team. There's eight of them of the 1959 side still alive. Martin O'Morrissey, my namesake, Larry Guinan, Mick Flannelly, Freddie O'Brien, Jackie Condon, Austin Flynn, Mick O'Connor, Tom Cunningham. And they're heroes for Waterford. But Waterford, obviously, and those men indeed, want new heroes and new All-Ireland champions. And led by Conor Prunty, Waterford have been under Liam Cahill this year, as you know, Damien, outstanding and growing and growing and growing. But the team so far that's unbeaten going into this All-Ireland final, 12 unbeaten games. They've won the Munster League, they've won the National League, they've won the Munster Championship. And that is the team from Limerick, and they have some again outstanding players: Keane Lynch, Dara Donovan, Garrod Hegarty, Tom Morrissey, Aaron Gillan. It's good news for Limerick. He recovered from his injury that he picked up against Galway, and he will line out at top of the right. So we're really looking forward to it. No matter where you are in the world, I think people will be in their colours, in their sitting rooms and kitchens, shouting and roaring at the television and listening indeed on the radio, where RT will also have coverage. So and looking forward to a great All-Ireland final, despite nobody being there.
And if you are watching it on television, it'll be the great Marty, Ireland's sexiest man, that'll actually be commentating. Now, take a listen to this.
Hi, Marty here. Santa tells me you've been so good this year. Have a magical time this Christmas. Happy Christmas.
So, Marty, you're on Christmas cards and you have jerseys all for a good cause. Briefly, will you tell us a little bit more about the Marty Party cards and the jerseys?
Well, to be honest with you, Damien, I suppose I've been inspired and lucky enough over the last number of years. I go with the All-Ireland champions on the Monday after the All-Ireland final to the Children's Hospital in Crumlin and to Temple Street. And I think that the doctors, staff, nurses, they do just an incredible job. But to meet those beautiful children and their worried parents, I thought this year we're not going to be able to do that. So I just got this idea, because I'm often asked, as you are indeed, to do little clips of videos for people who are celebrating birthdays. I thought if I could put the two together. So I came up with the idea of the Christmas cards, and Watermark cards came on board here in Dublin. And basically, once they covered their costs, everything else goes to the Children's Hospital Fund for Crumlin and indeed Temple Street, the Children's Hospital Foundation. And also I went to O'Neill's, I went to Tony Towell, and I said, look, this is probably a daft idea, but I just thought, could we come up with a jersey and again donate everything to Children's Hospital? And O'Neill's came on board. But because my idea was lastminute.com, Damien, which is typical of me, they were so busy, they could only do a certain amount. So we've put them up for a raffle. We've developed a justgiving.com/fundraising/Marty jerseys. You put in a little contribution, a minimum of a fiver. Everything goes to the Children's Hospital, and you're in a draw for four sets of jerseys, which we'll do next Sunday after the football final.
Well, that's brilliant, Marty, and we've retweeted your tweet on that. And have a great day tomorrow. Enjoy the camogie later on this evening, and fair play to you and well done on that initiative. That's the great Marty Morrissey, who'll be with you here in this seat in a few weeks' time once again. Well, from Ireland's current sexiest man to one that was had that title probably in the past, Paddy Cole. I'm on a roll here this morning. How
maybe,
are you?
Maybe about 50 years ago or something like that, yeah.
But it was true, wasn't it?
Oh, it very much so. I agree with that anyway, Damien.
Yeah. And I was reading about it actually in your new book, which is Paddy Cole, King of the Swingers, written with Tom Gilmore. It was really your I suppose, COVID lockdown project to get you through the summer, Paddy. And it's a fantastic read. But before we go into that, you do have an interest in tomorrow's hurling.
Yeah, well, my wife Helen comes from Limerick. Her brother John played for Limerick Miners. I remember going to see him in Croke Park.
John Hare.
Mm. And so there'll be divided sort of loyalties tomorrow, because I suppose we're typical Irish, we're always for the kind of for the underdog. We were all screaming our heads off for Limerick last year and all that. But
Does that mean you were cheering for Cavan last Sunday?
My grandfather was a Cavan man, so we always said, and we, like, over the years, unfortunately, when I was growing up, we didn't have much to cheer about in Monaghan, so we always followed Cavan.
Ah, that's good to hear.
And I was delighted with Cavan.
How things have changed,
yeah. Well, like, I mean, and I suppose when you look at Donegal, they put a fierce effort in and they were caught on the hop, but Cavan were awesome that day against Donegal.
Well, listen, as you said, Monaghan, Castle Blaney, that was your home. You were one of seven. You had six sisters to look after you, Paddy.
That's
and,
right,
Your dad was Paddy Senior. Your mother, Mary Hughes as well. They were very much like a lot of people, but in your case, they were your influence.
Oh, very much so. My father was a musician. He played saxophone in a dance orchestra at the time, sitting down reading music and that, and he taught me music, and he also taught me trout fishing and how to drive a car and all that. He was a great guy. But, every time I came home from school, he had me in front of a music tutor, and I had to have this piece off by the time he came in that evening. He drove the mail van at the post office, and when he came in the evenings, I had to know that part, and I hated it at the beginning because I could hear the guys playing football out on the road, and I wanted to be out there, you know. Yeah. But then I started listening to his LPs at the time on the old gramophone, and they developed a real love for American jazz, big bands, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, all that. And then I started playing a Morris Lynch's band, and that was a great job for me.
But you didn't think it was going to be a job. You were going to be either a butcher, an electrician, or what was the other job you could have?
I was going to be a guard as
or
well.
A guard, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you had the Irish. You were good at Irish at school.
Yeah,
you had the height.
Tom Shin, and I had the height. Yeah, and Sergeant Muldoon, a local sergeant. In fairness to him, he was like a career guidance man at the time. We didn't realise. He came to the house. I'd gotten a couple of scholarships around the first in Donegal, and he said, Paddy should join the Guards. And sure, I loved it. I was playing with Morris Lynch's band. I didn't want to know about the Guards. My dad, Lord rest him, tried to compromise on it. And he said, maybe you could join the Garda band. And that was on the cards for a while, but right. No, it
well,
didn't
had
happen.
You joined the Guards, you might have been a star in the Garda band and playing out in Croke Park before in All-Ireland and all of that.
And I said to one of the commissioners one time at a function, he said, I believe you nearly joined the Guards. And I said, it's a good job for you because I'd be the commissioner now.
Well, you lived along the border, and lady, you mightn't get into the Guards because you might have been caught actually smuggling, and you'd have a criminal record. Did you ever smuggle?
I did, yes. I admit it. Albeit very small stuff. We used to go to Cross Madeleine and we'd smuggle a couple of loaves of white bread and maybe a gallon of paraffin oil or something like that, you know. And the customs men knew what was going on, but they were after the guys.
Why would you be smuggling butter?
Well, butter and stuff was cheaper in the north at the time. The bread was supposed to be whiter, which now, when you think of it, maybe wasn't such a good thing. But the customs men were after the guys that were smuggling lorry loads of pigs. And we lived right across the road from the customs post. And maybe 5 o'clock in the morning, you'd be wakened with the squealing of pigs outside. And you knew that a lorry load of pigs after being caught. Ironically enough, that building was knocked down, and a new office block, a two-storey office block, and now there's a mural to me on that. I never thought that I'd be on a mural at the customs post.
Of all places. Maybe they knew. There's a message there, Paddy. But it's interesting you lived along the border, and here we are talking about Brexit again. And I know you speak in the book about how, you know, music transcended politics and religion and all of that. And I was reading something quite interesting. You could almost say, now maybe this is a little bit of a stretch, but you could almost say it was true the show bands and through the dance halls that we actually had a peace process, might have had it anyway, but Albert Reynolds, who was a show band manager before he was Taoiseach, he reached out to Ian Paisley via a show band, a ballroom owner, am I right?
I was talking to Albert about that and I said, how did you ever make contact with Ian Paisley? And he said, I got on to Sammy Barr. And Sammy Barr owned the ballroom in Ballymena and was a great friend of Ian Paisley's. And he said, the word came back from Ian Paisley saying, I can't meet you at the moment, but I will meet you at some stage. And subsequently, they did meet up. And that was, Albert was great at networking like that, you know. And in fairness, Tom Gilmore got all those stories out of me. He was a great man. Like, as you said, it was during the lockdown, the cocooning, and he would ring me. And if somebody had said to me, start at the beginning of your life, like as a young kid in Castleblaney learning the sax and go right through, I wouldn't have been able to do it, but he followed up and got all those stories.
And listen, it's full of wonderful stories. And of course, moving bands was a bit like moving soccer teams now, wasn't it? You joined bands and you signed for bands and stuff. And,
That's right.
The Capital then was the big move to Dublin. And then from there to Brendan Boyer and the Big Eight in Las Vegas. Yeah. And then back to Ireland to the Paddy Cole All-Stars.
Yeah.
And then into the cabaret scene. So that was your career, as it were, moving around.
Yeah, moving right along, yeah.
And when you mention Albert Reynolds, and look, like you don't take a drink now. And
no.
People probably think, oh, well, sure, anybody in the show band area doesn't take a drink now. They must have had a problem with it. But I was interested to read in your book, you didn't have a problem with drink or anything like that, but you got a scare.
Jim Hand, somebody said to Jim Hand years ago, I believe he had a problem with the drink. He says, no, I can get as much as I want. But,
but it was Albert as well that put you off.
Yeah, Albert, one time we were going to do a gig in Donegal with the Capital Show Band and there was a terrible tragedy. A band had crashed the night before, a Derry band, and four guys were killed. So all gigs were off. And we were coming back and we stopped in Longford. I used to drink a bottle of Guinness or something like that at the time. But the boys were ordering up brandies and all this. And sure, I ordered a brandy, being the hard man. Like, and Albert was shoving double brandies into me, even though Albert didn't drink himself. And he was given double brandies. I never was as sick in my life. And I never drank a brandy ever after. And he often said to me afterwards, I put you off ever being influenced
he
by
knew
drinking
he was
brandy. Yeah.
But you did, as you said, you'd have a few pints after, you know, when you'd be playing in the Harcourt there and the cabarets or whatever. And then you got a bit of a scare, isn't that right?
Yeah, I had nodules on the throat and I went into the ear, nose and throat hospital and the specialist there said to me, I don't think it's cancer, but if it is, we have it at an early stage. And he put me into a recovery room where I looked out at Adelaide Road at a tree. I still look at that tree when I pass it. And it's amazing how you would lie there and start making your plans, saying, my God, well, if this is the worst, you know. But there was a girl worked in the hospital at the time from Castleblaney. She was a matron or a ward sister. And she phoned me after a couple of days and said, Paddy, never let on, I told you, but you got the all clear. But when you come in now in another few days' time, act really surprised and delighted and all that, you know. But it was a scare at the time. Yeah. And just, he said to me, don't take a drink now for a while because it will impede the
recovery.
Recovery process. Yeah. And I haven't had a drink since.
Right, and that was 30-odd years ago. And it's probably maybe prolonged your career because there's a lot of use of the vocal cords with everything. And
yeah, and as well as that, Damien, being deadly honest about it, a lot of my colleagues and a lot of people in the business that died, some of them anyway, it was drink was the root cause of it.
Yeah, you were never too far away from it when you were travelling around.
It was
and
always
whatever.
There.
And listen, you're sounding great, you're looking great. And on the eve of your 81st birthday, next Thursday, am I right? You're
81 next Thursday. But I have to say to you, Damien, I think I said this before, you know the three stages of ageing. Young, middle-aged and you're looking great. So
sorry for falling into that trap.
You fell into it in the zoo as well.
I did. I did. Yeah, you were with us in the zoo last year, by the way.
Yeah, that was wonderful. Wonderful morning.
Those were the days when we had an audience.
Oh,
we get
God,
back to those days. The book is absolutely fantastic. You know what I like about it? There's loads of, it's not as if there's wonderful reading, but you have a wonderful collection of photographs. There's you and Roy Rogers, for
example.
And Muhammad Ali, Elvis. Yeah. I mean, you've met all of the greats and you've made some great friends.
I was very lucky, Damien, in the career I was in to meet all these people. Yeah. And like I've said before, Helen and myself might be sitting watching a movie at home, and it might be in Jamaica, it might be the Middle East, and we'd say, do you remember the time we were there?
Isn't that brilliant?
We got to travel the world. Like,
you did. And yeah. you've grandchildren now, and the family are all keeping well, and I know you're all very close, and you refer to that in the book as well. Before I let you go, Paddy, I have a question to ask you. When you were back smuggling butter and paraffin oil...
You're going to keep up this...
I know you had a great career as well, by the way. did you ever cook a goose for Christmas?
Oh, we used to have a goose. My uncle Tommy Cole used to. He was a fowl dealer, as we called them at that time. They had lorry went round the country and bought from the farmers and bought chickens and hens and at Christmas geese.
Right.
And the goose was a traditional thing at that time. And when we were young fellas, and we used to pluck the chickens. But at the turkeys at Christmas was a tough job. I can tell you, when you were a young fella and somebody threw a big cocked turkey into your shoulder, over your shoulder, and said, pluck that one. You were there for a long time.
You were there for a long time.
No, the goose was great.
Yeah.
Oh,
no, the reason I asked that is because our last item is in relation to that. But before I go to it, I want to say, Paddy, congratulations. It's a wonderful book. Genuinely it is. I really enjoyed reading it, even for somebody that was, you were well on the road by the time I was getting it to listen. But it's called Paddy Cole, King of the Swingers, My Story with Tom Gilmore, and it's printed by O'Brien.
Thank you so much.
And it's a great Christmas present. Happy Christmas, Paddy.
Same to you.
Always great to see you. We'll see you, King of the Swinger.
Give me regards to your mum and dad.
I will, and to your wife, Helen, as well, of course. Thanks, Paddy. Well, we are talking about the Christmas goose because one person that still cooks the goose for Christmas is Catherine Quinn, who farms in County Limerick, along with her granddaughter, Hannah. She not only cooks a goose for Christmas, but she wears a flock of them in preparation for the celebrations.
That didn't take much, did it?
No. The donkey thinks she'd like some barley too.
So would you always keep geese for Christmas? I know as a child we've always had geese for Christmas on the farm, but what about you growing up?
Geese were very common for the festive season before the turkey became popular. Nowadays, the number of people keeping geese are very few and far between.
Jim, come on, leave the geese alone. Let them have their breakfast. Good boy.
But
good boy.
They were very useful for their feathers. And my father would pluck them in the summertime, around June, and save the feathers and sell them if we didn't need them ourselves.
It must have looked funny waddling around, like a freshly shorn sheep, but a goose or something like that.
They did, yes, they did. They looked like that, and they would sort of go off and shake themselves and look, and they looked really odd for a couple of weeks. But... the feathers were quite valuable in those days for making eiderdowns and pillows.
And we keep about 10 geese every year, but we just kind of give them as presents, don't we? That's always been our tradition.
Yes, we give them as presents to friends and family. I've never ever sold a goose.
Obviously, we're going to have goose for Christmas again this year, and we're going to do a test run today, aren't we?
We are, yes. We love our goose and gooseberry sauce. And yes, we're looking forward to some goose today.
So we're back in our kitchen and you have the goose prepared. I've had very little to do with it, I have to admit. So how did you go about preparing it?
Well, I just prepared some sage and onion stuffing and pepper and salt and a little bit of thyme as well.
Yeah, you make it sound easy, but your stuffing is delicious. You always use fresh herbs. You grow herbs every year in your garden.
Fresh herbs, fresh sage and thyme, and a little bit of butter. And so we'll put it in the aga for roughly 2 hours.
And how did you cook it growing up, though? Did you have to cook it over an open fire?
Yes, we cooked it over an open fire. In the bastable, which was used for baking bread.
So like a big pot, essentially.
Yeah, a big pot with a lid on, do you know?
I mean, there were 9 children in your family. Was this a massive treat? Because I remember you telling me that some days you wouldn't eat meat. You know,
no.
You didn't have meat every single day growing up.
No, we would have potatoes and butter and milk. And that would be it.
So Christmas was huge.
A big treat. Christmas was a big treat. And I remember it actually as being such a lovely day. You know, a big long table with all 11 of us. And great fun.
And did you get presents or what happened on Christmas Day?
I think Santa came a few times. We would get oranges and bananas and all sorts of lovely things like that that we wouldn't get during the year. So it was a big occasion.
And you always say your mother was an exceptional good cook. I mean, does the goose of Christmas for you, when you were a child, does that kind of stand out in your memory?
Oh, it does very much. For me, having roast goose on Christmas Day is Christmas.
Okay, so this is the test run, so we have 2 hours to wait now.
Yes.
So I'm on guard duty while you go outside, is that right?
You can prepare the vegetables, Hannah, and make the gooseberry sauce. I trust you to do that.
That's very kind of you, thank you. So the 2 hours is up now. Do you need some oven gloves?
Oh my goodness, that looks amazing.
I did an all right job, so did I?
Yeah, lovely golden brown, perfect.
Smells amazing, but I think that's your stuffing more than anything else.
Yeah, well, it's a goose as well. Make sure it's good to chat. Yeah.
I guess.
That's it, yes.
So how many people could this goose feed?
About 8, I suppose. Do you know, we would, for Christmas, we would usually have about 8 people, but this year is going to be very different.
It'd just be you and me for Christmas this year.
Yeah. Just unfortunate that people can't manage the coming and the self-isolating in time for Christmas Day. But we're looking forward to Christmas Day. We're going to go for a drive in the pony and trap, which we always do at Christmas time. And we decorate the pony with antlers and a bit of tinsel. And good thing she can't see herself, because I don't think she'd be impressed. We'll enjoy our goose again and gooseberry sauce.
And we're looking forward to next year. I think we're a little bit sad about it, maybe, but I think everyone just has to live through it this year, don't they?
Yes. Look forward to next year. And we're very lucky, of course, to live in the country and have the animals to look after, particularly the cows. They're so affectionate and they're great company, I have to say. So, yes.
And I'm lucky to have you.
Oh, thank you, Hannah.
That's lovely, coming up to Christmas. Wouldn't that make the mouth water as well, listening to them cooking the goose there? That's Catherine Quinn and her granddaughter Hannah Quinn Mulligan, bringing Countrywide to an end for this week. Thanks to Eileen, Brian and Pather on the production team. Stay tuned for playback after the 9 news here in Radio 1, and Ear to the Ground on Thursday at 8:30 on RT Radio 1. Until next time, bye-bye and thanks for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.